This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Death Masks by Jim Butcher, read by James Marsters. Chapter 1. Some things just aren't meant to go together. Things like oil and water, orange juice and toothpaste, wizards and television. Spotlights glared into my eyes. The heat of them threatened to make me sweat streaks through the pancake makeup some harried stagehand had slapped on me a few minutes before. Lights on top of cameras started winking on, the talk show theme song began to play, and the studio audience began to chant, "Larry, Larry, Larry." Larry Fowler, a short man in an immaculate suit, appeared from the doors at the rear of the studio and began walking to the stage, flashing his porcelain smile and shaking the hands of a dozen people seated at the ends of their rows as he passed them. The audience whistled and cheered as he did. The noise made me flinch in my seat up on the stage, and I felt a trickle of sweat slide down over my ribs beneath my white dress shirt and my jacket. I briefly considered running away screaming. It isn't like I have stage fright or anything, see? Because I don't. It was just really hot up there. I licked my lips and checked all the fire exits just to be safe. No telling when you might need to make a speedy exit. The lights and noise made it a little difficult to keep up my concentration, and I felt the spell I'd woven around me wobble. I closed my eyes for a second until I had stabilized it again. In the chair beside me sat a dumpy, balding man in his late 40s, dressed in a suit that looked a lot better than mine. Mortimer Lindquist waited calmly, a polite smile on his face, but muttered out of the corner of his mouth, "You okay? I've been in house fires that I like better than this." "You asked for this meeting, not me," Mortimer said. He frowned as Fowler lingered over shaking a young woman's hand.
"Showboat."
"Think this'll take long?" I asked Morty. He glanced beside him at an empty chair and at another beside me.
"Two mystery guests. I guess this one could go for a while. They shoot extra material and edit it down to the best parts."
I sighed. I'd been on the Larry Fowler show just after I'd gone into business as an investigator, and it had been a mistake. I'd had to fight my way uphill against the tide of infamy I'd received from association with the show.
"What did you find out?" I asked.
Mort flicked a nervous glance at me and said,
"Not much."
"Come on, Mort." He opened his mouth to answer, then glanced up as Larry Fowler trotted up the stairs and onto the stage.
"Not now. Wait for a commercial break."
Larry Fowler pranced up to us and pumped my hand, then Mort's with equally exaggerated enthusiasm. "Welcome to the show," he said into a handheld microphone, then turned to face the nearest camera. "Our topic for today is witchcraft and wizardry, phony or fabulous? With us, in order to share their views, our local medium and psychic counselor, Mortimer Lindquist." The audience applauded politely. "And beside him, Harry Dresden, Chicago's only professional wizard." There was a round of snickering laughter to go with the applause this time. I couldn't say I was shocked. People don't believe in the supernatural these days. Supernatural things are scary. It's much more comfortable to rest secure in the knowledge that no one can reach out with magic and quietly kill you, that vampires exist only in movies, and that demons are mere psychological dysfunctions. Completely inaccurate, but much more comfortable. Despite the relative levels of denial, my face heated up. I hate it when people laugh at me. An old, quiet hurt mixed in with my nervousness, and I struggled to maintain the suppression spell. "Yeah," I said, "spell. See, I really am a wizard. I do magic. I've run into vampires and demons and a lot of things in between, and I've got the scars to show for it. The problem was that technology doesn't seem to enjoy coexisting with magic. When I'm around, computers crash, light bulbs burn out, and car alarms start screaming in warbling, drunken voices for no good reason. I'd worked out a spell to suppress the magic I carried with me, at least temporarily, so that I might at least have a chance to keep from blowing out the studio lights and cameras or setting off the fire alarms. It was delicate stuff by its very nature, and extremely difficult for me to hold in place. So far so good, but I saw the nearest cameraman wince and jerk his headset away from his ear. Whining feedback sounded tinnily from the headset. I closed my eyes and reined in my discomfort and embarrassment, focusing on the spell. The feedback died away. "Well, then," Larry said, after half a minute of happy talk. "Morty, you've been a guest on the show several times now. Would you care to tell us a little bit about what you do?" Mortimer widened his eyes and whispered,
"I see dead people."
The audience laughed. "But seriously, mostly I conduct seances, Larry," Mortimer said. "I do what I can to help those who have lost a loved one, or who need to contact them in the beyond in order to resolve issues left undone back here on Earth. I also offer a prediction service in order to help clients make decisions on upcoming issues and try to warn them against possible danger." "Really?" Larry said. "Could you give us a demonstration?" Mortimer closed his eyes and rested the fingertips of his right hand on the spot between his eyes. Then, in a hollow voice, he said, "The spirits tell me that two more guests will soon arrive." The audience laughed, and Mortimer nodded at them with an easy grin. He knew how to play a crowd. Larry gave Mortimer a tolerant smile. "And why are you here today?" "Larry, I just want to try to raise public awareness about the realm of the psychic and paranormal. Nearly 80% of a recent survey of American adults stated that they believed in the existence of the spirits of the dead, in ghosts. I just want to help people understand that they do exist, and that there are other people out there who have had strange and inexplicable encounters with them." "Thank you, Morty. And Harry. May I call you Harry?" "Sure, it's your nickel," I responded. Larry's smile got a shade brittle. "Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?" "I'm a wizard," I said. "I find lost articles, investigate paranormal occurrences, and train people who find themselves struggling with a sudden development of their own abilities." "Isn't it true that you also consult for the Special Investigations Department at Chicago PD?" "Occasionally," I said. I wanted to avoid talking about SI if I could. The last thing CPD would want was to be advertised on the Larry Fowler show. Many police departments across the country employ such consultants when all other leads have failed. "And why are you here today?" "Because I'm broke and your producer is paying double my standard fee." The crowd laughed again, more warmly. Larry Fowler's eyes flashed with an impatient look behind his glasses, and his smile turned into a gnashing of teeth. "No, really, Harry, why?" "For the same reasons as Morty here," I answered. Which was true. I'd come here to meet Mort and get some information from him. He'd come here to meet me, because he'd refuse to be seen near me on the street. I guess you could say I don't have the safest reputation in the world. "And you claim to be able to do magic," Larry said.
"Yeah."
"Could you show us?" Larry prompted.
"I could, Larry, but I don't think it's practical."
Larry nodded and gave the audience a wise look.
"And why is that?"
"Because it would probably wreck your studio equipment."
"Of course," Larry said. He winked at the audience.
"Well, we wouldn't want that, would we?"
There was more laughter and a few catcalls from the crowd. Passages from Carrie and Firestarter sprang to mind, but I restrained myself and maintained the suppression spell. Master of self-discipline, that's me. But I gave the fire door beside the stage another longing look. Larry carried on the talk part of the talk show, discussing crystals and ESP and tarot cards. Mort did most of the talking. I chimed in with monosyllables from time to time. After several minutes of this, Larry said, "We'll be right back after these announcements." Stagehands held up signs that read applause, and cameras panned and zoomed over the audience as they whistled and hooted. Larry gave me an annoyed look and strode off stage. In the wings, he started tearing into a makeup girl about his hair. I leaned over to Mort and said, Okay, what did you find out?
The dumpy ectomancer shook his head.
Nothing concrete. I'm still getting back into the swing of things and contacting the dead.
Even so, you've got more contacts in this area than I do, I said. My sources don't keep close track of who has or hasn't died lately, so I'll take whatever I can get. Is she at least alive?
He nodded. She's alive. That much I know. She's in Peru.
Peru? It came as a vast relief to hear that she wasn't dead, but what the hell was Susan doing in Peru?
That's Red Court territory.
Some, Mort agreed,
though most of them are in Brazil and the Yucatan. I tried to find out exactly where she was, but I was blocked.
By who?
Mort shrugged. No way for me to tell. I'm sorry.
I shook my head.
No, it's okay. Thanks, Mort.
I settled back in my seat, mulling over the news. Susan Rodriguez was a reporter for a regional yellow paper called the Midwestern Arcane. She'd grown interested in me just after I opened up my practice, hounding me relentlessly to find out more about all the things that go bump in the night. We'd gotten involved, and on our first date, she wound up lying naked on the ground in a thunderstorm while lightning cooked a toad-like demon to gooey bits. After that, she parlayed a couple of encounters with things from my cases into a widespread syndicated column. A couple of years later, she wound up following me into a nest of vampires holding a big to-do, despite all of my warnings to the contrary. A noble of the Red Court of Vampires had grabbed her and begun the transformation from mortal to vampire on her. It was payback for something I'd done. The vampire noble in question thought that her standing in the Red Court made her untouchable, that I wouldn't want to start trouble with the entire court. She told me that if I fought to take Susan back, I would be starting a worldwide war between the White Council of Wizards and the vampire's Red Court. Which I did. The vampires hadn't forgiven me for taking Susan back from them, probably because a bunch of them, including one of their nobility, had been incinerated in the process. That's why Mort didn't want to be seen with me. He wasn't involved in the war, and he intended to keep it that way. In any case, Susan hadn't gone all the way through her transformation, but the vamps had given her their bloodthirst, and if she ever gave in to it, she'd become one of the Red Court. I asked her to marry me, promising her that I'd find a way to restore her humanity. She turned me down and left town, trying to sort things out on her own, I guess. I still kept trying to find a way to remove her affliction, but I'd received only a card and a postcard or three from her since she'd left. 2 weeks ago, her editor had called to say that the columns she usually sent in for the Arcane were late, and asked if I knew how to get in touch with her. I hadn't, but I started looking. I got zip and went to Mort Lindquist to see if his contacts in the spirit world would pay off better than mine. I hadn't gotten much, but at least she was alive. Muscles in my back unclenched a little. I looked up to see Larry come back on stage to his theme music. Speakers squealed and squelched when he started to talk, and I realized I'd let my control slip again. The suppression spell was a hell of a lot harder than I thought it would be, and getting harder by the minute. I tried to focus, and the speakers quieted to the occasional fitful pop. "Welcome back to the show," Larry told the camera. "Today we're speaking with practitioners of the paranormal, who are here to share their views with the studio audience and our viewers at home. In order to explore these issues further, I have asked a couple of experts with opposing viewpoints to join us today, and here they are." The audience applauded as a pair of men emerged from either side of the stage. The first man sat down in the chair by Morty. He was a little over average height and thin, his skin burned into tanned leather by the sun. He might have been anywhere between 40 and 60. His hair was graying and neatly cut, and he wore a black suit with a white clerical collar sharing space with a rosary and crucifix at his throat. He smiled and nodded to Mort and me and shook hands with Larry. Larry said, "Allow me to introduce Father Vincent, who has come all the way from the Vatican to be with us today. He is a leading scholar and researcher within the Catholic Church on the subject of witchcraft and magic. both historically and from a psychological perspective. Father, welcome to the show.
Vincent's voice was a little rough, but he spoke English with the kind of cultured accent that seemed to indicate an expensive education.
Thank you, Larry. I'm very pleased to be here.
I looked from Father Vincent to the second man, who had settled in the chair beside me, just as Larry said, and from the University of Brazil at Rio de Janeiro, please welcome Dr. Paulo Ortega, world-renowned researcher and debunker of the supernatural.
Larry started saying something else, but I didn't hear him. I just stared at the man beside me as recognition dawned. He was of average height and slightly heavy build, with broad shoulders and a deep chest. He was dark-complected, his black hair neatly brushed, his gray and silver suit stylish and tasteful. And he was a duke of the Red Court, an ancient and deadly vampire, smiling at me from less than an arm's length away. My heart rate went from 60 to 150 million, fear sending silver lightning racing down my limbs. Emotions have power. They fuel a lot of my magic. The fear hit me, and the pressure on the suppression spell redoubled. There was a flash of light and a puff of smoke from the nearest camera, and the operator staggered back from it, tearing off his headphones with one of the curses they have to edit out of daytime TV. Smoke began to rise steadily from the camera, along with the smell of burning rubber, and the studio monitors shrieked with feedback.
"Well," Ortega said under his breath, "nice to see you again, Mr. Dresden."
I swallowed and fumbled at my pocket where I had a couple of wizard gadgets I used for self-defense. Ortega put his hand on my arm. It didn't look as if he was exerting himself, but his fingers closed on my wrist like manacles, hard enough to send flashes of pain up through my elbow and shoulder. I looked around, but everyone was staring at the malfunctioning camera.
"Relax," Ortega said, his accent thick and vaguely Latinate. "I am not going to kill you on television, wizard. I'm here to talk to you."
"Get off me," I said. My voice was thin, shaky. Goddamn stage fright. He released me, and I jerked my arm away. The crew rolled the smoking camera back, and a director type with a set of headphones made a rolling motion with the fingers of one hand. Larry nodded to him and turned to Ortega.
"Sorry about that. We'll edit that part out later."
"It's no trouble," Ortega assured him.
Jerry paused for a moment and then said, "Dr. Ortega, welcome to the show. You have a reputation as one of the premier analysts of paranormal phenomena in the world. You have proven that a wide variety of so-called supernatural occurrences were actually clever hoaxes. Can you tell us a little about that?"
"Certainly. I have investigated these events for a number of years, and I have yet to find one that cannot be adequately explained. Alleged alien crop circles prove to be nothing more than a favorite pastime of a small group of British farmers, for example. Other odd events are certainly unusual, but by no means supernatural. Even here in Chicago, you had a rain of toads in one of your local parks, witnessed by dozens, if not hundreds, of people. And it turned out later that a freak windstorm had scooped them up from elsewhere and deposited them here."
Larry nodded, his expression serious.
"Then you don't believe in these events?"
Ortega gave Larry a patronizing smile.
"I would love to believe that such things are true, Larry. There is little enough magic in the world. But I am afraid that even though we each have a part of us that wishes to believe in wondrous beings and fantastic powers, the fact of the matter is that it is simple, primitive superstition."
"Then, in your opinion, practitioners of the supernatural..."
"Frauds," Ortega said with certainty. "With no offense meant to your guests, of course. All of these so-called mediums, presuming they aren't self-deluded, are simply skilled actors who have acquired a fundamental grasp of human psychology and know how to exploit it. They are easily able to deceive the gullible into believing that they can contact the dead or read thoughts or that they are in fact supernatural beings. Why, with a few minutes' effort and the right setting, I am certain that I could convince anyone in this room that I was a vampire myself. People laughed again. I scowled at Ortega, frustration growing once more, putting more pressure on the suppression spell. The air around me started to feel warmer. A second cameraman yelped and jerked off his squealing earphones while his camera started spinning about slowly on its stand, winding power cables around the steel frame it rested on. The on-air lights went out. Larry stepped to the edge of the stage, yelling at the poor cameraman. The apologetic-looking director appeared from the wings, and Larry turned his attention to him. The man bore the scolding with a kind of oxen-like patience and then examined the camera. He muttered something into his headset, and he and the shaken cameraman began to wheel the dead camera away. Larry folded his arms impatiently, then turned to the guests and said, "I'm sorry. Give us a couple of minutes to get a spare camera in. It won't take long."
"No problem, Larry," Ortega assured him. "We can just chat for a moment."
Larry peered at me. "Are you all right, Mr. Dresden?" he asked. "You look a little pale. Could you use a drink or something?"
"I know I could," Ortega said, his eyes on me.
"I'll have someone bring them out," Larry said, and strode off stage toward his hairstylist. Mort had engaged Father Vincent in quiet conversation, his back very firmly turned toward me. I turned back to Ortega, warily, my back stiff, and fought down the anger and fear. Usually being scared out of my mind is kind of useful. Magic comes from emotions, and terror is handy fuel. But this wasn't the place to start calling up gales of wind or flashes of fire. There were too many people around, and it would be too easy to get someone hurt, even killed. Besides which, Ortega was right. This wasn't the place to fight. If he was here, he wanted to talk. Otherwise, he would have simply jumped me in the parking garage.
"Okay," I said finally. "What do you want to say?"
He leaned a little closer so that he wouldn't have to raise his voice. I cringed inwardly, but I didn't flinch away.
"I've come to Chicago to kill you, Mr. Dresden. But I have a proposal for you that I want you to hear first."
"You really need to work on your opening technique," I said. "I read a book about negotiations. I could loan it to you." He gave me a humorless smile.
"The war, Dresden. The war between your people and mine is too costly for both of us."
"War's a pretty stupid option to take, generally speaking," I said. "I never wanted it."
"But you began it," Ortega said. "You began it over a point of principle."
"I began it over a human life."
"And how many more would you save by ending it now?" Ortega asked. "Not merely wizards suffer from this. Our attention to the war leaves us less able to control the wilder elements of our own court. We frown upon reckless killings, but wounded or leaderless members of our courts often kill when they do not truly need to. Ending the war now would save hundreds, perhaps thousands of lives."
"So would killing every vampire on the planet. What's your point?" Ortega smiled, showing teeth. Just regular teeth, no long canines or anything. The vampires of the Red Court look human, right up until they turn into something out of a nightmare.
"The point, Dresden, is that the war is unprofitable, undesirable. You are the symbolic cause of it to my people, and the point of contention between us and your own White Council. Once you are slain, the Council will accept peace overtures, as will the court."
"So you're asking me to lay down and die? That's not much of an offer. You really need to read that book."
"I'm making you an offer. Face me in single combat, Dresden."
I didn't quite laugh at him. "Why the hell should I do that?" His eyes were expressionless.
"Because if you do, it would mean that the warriors I have brought to town with me will not be forced to target your friends and allies." that the mortal assassins we have retained will not need to receive their final confirmations to kill a number of clients who have hired you in the past 5 years. I'm sure I need not mention names. Fear and anger had been about to settle down, but they came surging back again.
There's no reason for that, I said. If your war is with me, keep it with me.
Gladly, Ortega said. I do not approve of such tactics. Face me under the dueling laws in the Accords.
And after I kill you, what? I said. I didn't know if I could kill him, but there was no reason to let him think I wasn't confident about it. The next hotshot Red Duke does the same thing?
Defeat me, and the court has agreed that this city will become neutral territory. That those living in it, including yourself and your friends and associates, will be free of the threat of attack so long as they are in it. I stared hard at him for a moment. Chicago Blanca, eh? He quirked a puzzled eyebrow at me. Never mind, after your time. I looked away from him and licked sweat from my upper lip. A stagehand came by with a couple of bottled waters and passed them to Ortega and to me. I took a drink. The pressure of the spell made flickering colored dots float across my vision.
You're stupid to fight me, I said. Even if you kill me, my death curse would fall on you.
He shrugged. I am not as important as the whole of the court. I will take that risk.
Hell's bells. Dedicated, honorable, courageous, self-sacrificial loonies are absolutely the worst people in the world to go up against. I tried one last dodge, hoping it might pay off.
I'd have to have it in writing. The council gets a copy, too. I want this all recognized official under the Accords.
That done, you will agree to the duel?
I took a deep breath. The last thing I wanted to do was square off against another supernatural nasty. Vampires scared me. They were strong and way too fast and had an enormous yuck factor. Their saliva was an addictive narcotic, and I'd been exposed to it enough to make me twitch once in a while, wondering what it would be like to get another hit. I barely went outside after dark these days, specifically because I didn't want to encounter any more vampires. A duel would mean a fair fight, and I hate fair fights. In the words of a murderous fairy queen, they're too easy to lose. Of course, if I didn't agree to Ortega's offer, I'd be fighting him anyway, probably at a time and place of his choosing, and I had the feeling that Ortega wasn't going to show the arrogance and overconfidence I'd seen in other vampires. Something about him said that so long as I wasn't breathing, he wouldn't care much how it happened. Not only that, but I believed that he would start in on the people I cared about if he couldn't have me.
I mean, come on. It was cliched villainy at its worst. And an undeniably effective lever.
I'd like to say that I carefully weighed all the factors, reasoned my way to a level-headed conclusion, and made a rational decision to take a calculated risk, but I didn't. The truth is, I thought of Ortega and company doing harm to some of the people I cared about, and suddenly felt angry enough to start in on him right there. I faced him, eyes narrowed, and didn't bother to hold the anger in check. The suppression spell began to crack, and I didn't bother to keep it going. The spell shattered, and the buildup of wild energy rushed silently and invisibly over the studio. There was a cough of static from the speakers on the stage before they died with loud pops. The floodlights overhead suddenly burst with flashes of brilliance and clouds of sparks that fell over everyone on the stage. One of the two surviving cameras exploded into fire, bluish flames rising up from out of the casing, and heavy power outlets along the walls started spitting orange and green sparks. Larry Fowler yelped and leaped up into the air, batting at his belt before pitching a smoldering cell phone to the floor. The lights died and people started screaming in startled panic. Ortega, lit only by the falling sparks, looked grim and somehow eager, shadows dancing over his features, his eyes huge and dark.
Fine, I said. Get it to me in writing and you've got a deal.
The emergency lights came up, fire alarms started whooping, and people started stumbling toward exits.
Ortega smiled, all teeth, and glided off the stage, vanishing into the wings. I stood up, shaking a little. A piece of something had apparently fallen and hit Mort's head. There was a small gash on his scalp, already brimming with blood, and he wobbled precariously when he tried to stand. I helped him up, and so did Father Vincent on the other side of him. We lugged the little ectomancer toward the fire doors. We got Mort down some stairs and outside the building. Chicago PD was on the scene already, blue and white lights flashing. Fire crews and an ambulance or three were just then rolling up on the street. We settled Mort down among a row of people with minor injuries and stood back. We were both panting a little as the emergency med techs started triage on the wounded.
"Actually, Mr. Dresden," Father Vincent said, "I must confess something to you."
"Huh," I said. "Don't think I missed the irony on that one, Padre."
Vincent's leathery mouth creased into a strained smile.
"I did not really come to Chicago merely to appear on the show."
"No," I said.
"No, I really came here to..."
"Talk to me," I interjected.
He lifted his eyebrows.
"How did you know?"
I sighed and got my car keys out of my pocket.
"It's just been that kind of day."
Chapter 2. I started walking for my car and beckoned Father Vincent to follow. He did, and I walked fast enough to make him work to keep up with me.
"You must understand," he said, "that I must insist upon strict confidentiality if I am to divulge details of my problem to you."
I frowned at him and said, "You think I'm a crackpot at best or a charlatan at worst, so why would you want me to take your case?"
Not that I would turn him down. I wanted to take his case. Well, more accurately, I wanted to take his money. I wasn't in the bad fiscal shape of the year before, but that meant only that I had to fend the creditors off with a baseball bat rather than a cattle prod.
"I am told you are the best investigator in the city for it," Father Vincent said.
I arched an eyebrow at him.
"You've got something supernatural going on?"
He rolled his eyes.
"No, naturally not. I am not a naive, Mr. Dresden. But I am told that you know more about the occult community than any private investigator in the city."
"Oh," I said, "that." I thought about it for a minute and figured it was probably true. The occult community he had in mind was the usual New Age, crystal-gazing, tarot-turning, palm-reading crowd you see in any large city. Most of them were harmless, and many had at least a little ability at magic. Add in a dash of feng shui artists, seasoned liberally with Wiccans of a variety of flavors and sincerities, blend in a few modestly gifted practitioners who liked mixing religion with their magic, some followers of voodoo, a few Santerians, and a sprinkling of Satanists, all garnished with a crowd of young people who like to wear a lot of black, and you get what most people think of as the occult community. Of course, hiding in there, you found the occasional sorcerer, necromancer, monster, or demon. The real players, the nasty ones, regarded that crowd the same way a 10-year-old would a gingerbread amusement park. My mental early warning system set off an imaginary klaxon.
"Who referred you to me, Padre?"
"Oh, a local priest," Vincent said.
He took a small notebook from his pocket, opened it, and read,
"Father Forthill, of St. Mary of the Angels."
I blinked. Father Forthill didn't see eye to eye with me on the whole religion thing, but he was a decent guy. A little stuffy, maybe, but I liked him, and I owed him for favors past.
"You should have said that in the first place."
"You'll take the case?"
Father Vincent asked as we headed into the parking garage.
"I want to hear the details first, but if Forthill thinks I can help, I will," I added hastily. "My standard fees apply."
"Naturally,"
Father Vincent said. He toyed with the crucifix at his throat.
"May I assume that you will spare me the magician rigmarole?"
"Wizard," I said.
"There's a difference?"
"Magicians do stage magic. Wizards do real magic." He sighed.
"I don't need an entertainer, Mr. Dresden, just an investigator."
"And I don't need you to believe me, Padre, just to pay me. We'll get along fine."
He gave me an uncertain look and said,
"Ah."
We reached my car, a battered old Volkswagen Bug named the Blue Beetle. It has what some people would call character, and what I would call lots of mismatched replacement parts. The original car may have been blue, but now it had pieces of green, white, and red VWs grafted onto it in place of the originals as they got damaged in one way or another. The hood had to be held down with a piece of hanger wire to keep it from flipping up when the car jounced, and the front bumper was still smashed out of shape from last summer's attempt at vehicular monster slaughter. Maybe if Vincent's job paid well, I'd be able to get it fixed. Father Vincent blinked at the Beetle and asked,
"What happened?"
"I hit trees."
"You drove your car into a tree?"
"No, trees, plural. And then a dumpster." I glanced at him self-consciously and added, "They were little trees." His uncertain look deepened to actual worry.
"Ah."
I unlocked my door. Not that I was worried about anyone stealing my car. I once had a car thief offer to get me something better for a sweetheart rate. "I guess you want to give me the details somewhere a little more private." Father Vincent nodded.
"Yes, of course. If you could take me to my hotel, I have some photographs and..."
I heard the scuff of shoes on concrete in time for me to catch the gunman in my peripheral vision as he rose from between a pair of parked cars one row over. Dim lights gleamed on the gun, and I threw myself across the hood of the Beetle away from him. I crashed into Father Vincent, who let out a squeak of startled surprise, and the pair of us tumbled to the ground as the man started shooting. The gun didn't split the air with thunder when it fired. Typically, guns do that. They're a hell of a lot louder than anything most folks run into on a day-to-day basis. This gun didn't roar, or bark, or even bang. It made a kind of loud noise. Maybe as loud as someone slamming an unabridged dictionary down on a table. The gunman was using a silencer. One shot hit my car and caromed off the curve of the hood. Another went by my head as I struggled with Father Vincent, and a third shattered the safety glass of a ritzy sports car parked beside me.
What's happening?
Father Vincent stammered.
Shut up,
I snarled. The gunman was moving, his feet scuffing on the concrete as he skirted around my car. I reached around the Beetle's headlight and fumbled at the wire holding the hood down while the man came closer. It gave way and the hood wobbled up as I reached into the storage compartment. I looked up in time to see a man, medium height and build, mid-30s, dark pants and jacket, lift a small caliber pistol, its end heavy with a manufactured silencer. He fired, but he hadn't taken time to aim at me. He wasn't 20 feet away, but he missed. I drew the shotgun out of the car's trunk and flicked off the safety as I chambered around. The gunman's eyes widened and he turned to run. He shot at me again on the way, shattering one of the Beetle's headlights, and he kept shooting toward me as he skittered back the way he came. I jerked back behind the car and kept my head down, trying to count his shots. He got to 11 or 12 and the gun went silent. I stood up, the shotgun already at my shoulder, and sighted down the barrel. The gunman ducked behind a concrete column and kept running.
"Damn it," I hissed. "Get in the car."
"But," Father Vincent stammered.
"Get in the car,"
I shouted. I got up, twisted the hanger wire on the hood back into place, and got in. Vincent got in the passenger side, and I shoved the shotgun at him.
"Hold this."
He fumbled with it, his eyes wide, as I brought the Beetle to life with a roar. Well, not really a roar. A Volkswagen Bug doesn't roar. But it sort of growled, and I mashed it into gear before the priest had managed to completely shut the door. I headed for the parking garage's exit, whipping around the ramps and turns.
"What are you doing?"
Father Vincent demanded.
"He's an outfit hitter," I spat. "They'll have the exit covered."
We screeched around the final corner and toward the parking garage's exit. I heard someone yelling in a breathless voice, and a couple of large and unfriendly-looking men in a car parked across the street were just getting out. One of them held a shotgun, and the other had a heavy-duty semi-automatic, maybe a Desert Eagle. I didn't recognize the thug with the shotgun, but thug number 3 was an enormous man with reddish hair, no neck, and a cheap suit. Cujo Hendricks, right-hand enforcer to the crime lord of Chicago, Gentleman Johnny Marcone. I had to bounce the beetle up onto the sidewalk at the parking garage exit to get around the security bar, and I mowed down some landscape bushes on the way. I jounced over the curb and into the street, hauling the wheel to the right, and mashed the accelerator to the floor. I glanced back and saw the original gunman standing at a fire exit door, pointing the silenced pistol at us. He snapped off several more shots, though I only heard the last few, as the silencer started to give out. He didn't have a prayer of a clean shot, but he got lucky and my back window shattered inward. I gulped and took the first corner against the light, nearly colliding with a U-Haul moving truck, and kept accelerating away. A couple of blocks later, my heart slowed down enough that I could think. I slowed the car down to something approaching the speed limit, thanked my lucky stars the suppression spell had fallen apart in the studio and not in the car, and rolled down my window. I stuck my head out for a second to see if Hendricks and his goons were following us, but I didn't see anyone coming along behind us and took it on faith. I pulled my head in and found the barrel of the shotgun pointed at my chin, while Father Vincent, his face pale, muttered to himself under his breath in Italian. "Hey," I said, and pushed the gun's barrel away. "Careful with that thing. You want to kill me?" I reached down and flicked the safety on. "Put it down. A patrolman sees that, and we're in trouble." Father Vincent gulped and tried to lower the gun below the level of the dash.
"This weapon is illegal?"
"Illegal is such a strong word," I muttered.
"Oh, my," Father Vincent said with a gulp. "Those men," he said, "they tried to kill you."
"That's what hitters for the outfit do," I agreed.
"How do you know who they are?"
"First guy had a silenced weapon. A good silencer, metal and glass, not a cheapo plastic bottle." I checked out the window again. "He was using a small caliber weapon, too, and he was trying to get real close before he started shooting."
"Why does that matter?"
It looked clear. My hands trembled and felt a little weak.
"Because it means he was using light ammunition, subsonic. If the bullet breaks the sound barrier, it sort of defeats the point of a silenced weapon.
When he saw I was armed, he ran, covered himself doing it, and went for help. He's a pro."
"Oh, my,"
Father Vincent said again. He looked a little pale. "Plus, I recognized one of the men waiting at the exit."
"Someone was at the exit?" Father Vincent said.
"Yeah, some of Marcone's rent-a-thugs." I glanced back at the shattered window and sighed.
"Damn it. So, where are we going?"
Father Vincent gave me directions in a numb voice, and I concentrated on driving, trying to ignore the quivering in my stomach and the continued trembling of my hands. Getting shot at is not something I handle very well. Hendricks. Why the hell was Marcone sending goons after me? Marcone was the lord of the mean streets of Second City, but generally he didn't like to use that kind of violence. He thought it was bad for business. I had believed Marcone and I had an understanding, or at least an agreement, to stay out of each other's way. So why would he make a move like this? Maybe I had already stepped over a line somewhere that I didn't know existed. I glanced at the shaken Father Vincent. He hadn't told me yet what he wanted, but whatever it was important enough to covertly drag one of the Vatican staff all the way to Chicago. Maybe it was important enough to kill a nosy wizard over, too. Oh, boy. It was turning into one hell of a day.
Chapter 3. Father Vincent directed me to a motel a little ways north of O'Hare. It was a national chain, cheap but clean, with rows of doors facing the parking lot. I drove around to the back of the motel, away from the street, frowning. It didn't look like the kind of place someone like Vincent would stay in. The priest left my car almost before I'd set the parking brake, hurried to the nearest door, and ducked inside as quickly as he could open the lock. I followed him. Vincent shut the door behind us, locked it, and then fiddled with the blinds until they closed. He nodded at the room's little table and said,
"Please, sit down."
I did, and stretched out my legs. Father Vincent pulled open a drawer on the plain dresser and drew out a file folder held closed with a wide rubber band. He sat down across from me, took off the rubber band, and said,
The church is interested in recovering some stolen property.
I shrugged and said, sounds like a job for the police.
An investigation is underway, and I'm giving the police department my full cooperation, but, how to phrase this politely, he frowned, history is an able teacher.
You don't trust the police, I said.
Gotcha.
He grimaced.
It is only that there have been a number of associations between Chicago police and various underworld figures in the past.
That's mostly movies now, Padre. You may not have heard, but the whole Al Capone thing has been over for a while.
Perhaps, he said. Perhaps not. I simply seek to do everything within my power to recover the stolen article. That includes involving an independent and discreet investigator.
Aha! So he didn't trust the police and wanted me to work for him on the sly. That's why we were meeting at a cheap motel, rather than wherever he was really staying. What do you want me to find for you?
A relic, he said.
A what?
An artifact, Mr. Dresden. An antique possessed by the church for several centuries.
Oh, that, I said.
Yes. The article is fragile and of great age, and we believe that it is not being adequately preserved. It is imperative that we recover it as quickly as possible.
What happened to it?
It was stolen 3 days ago.
From?
The Cathedral of St. John the Baptist in northern Italy.
Long ways off.
We believe that the artifact was brought here to Chicago to be sold.
Why? He took an 8x10 glossy black and white from the folder and passed it to me. It featured a fairly messy corpse lying on cobblestones. Blood had run into the spaces between the stones, as well as pooling a little on the ground around the body. I think it had been a man, but it was hard to tell for certain. Whoever it was had been slashed to almost literal ribbons across the face and neck. Sharp, neat, straight cuts. Professional knife work. Yuck.
This man is Gaston Laroche. He is the ringleader of a group of organized thieves who call themselves the Church Mice. They specialize in robbing sanctuaries and cathedrals. He was found dead the morning after the robbery near a small airfield. His briefcase contained several falsified pieces of American identification and plane tickets that would carry him here.
But no what's it?
Ah, exactly.
Father Vincent removed another pair of photos. These were also black and white, but they looked rougher, as if they had been magnified several times. Both were of women of average height and build, dark hair, dark sunglasses.
Surveillance photos? I asked.
He nodded. Interpol, Anna Valmont, and Francisco Garcia. We believe they helped Laroche with the theft, then murdered him and left the country. Interpol received a tip that Valmont had been seen at the airport here.
Do you know who the buyer is?
Vincent shook his head.
No, but this is the case. I want you to find the remaining church mice and recover the artifact.
I frowned, looking at the photos. Yeah, that's what they want you to do, too.
Vincent blinked at me.
What do you mean?
I shook my head impatiently. Someone? Look at this photo. Laroche wasn't murdered there.
Vincent frowned.
Why would you say that?
Not enough blood. I've seen men who were torn up and bled out. There's a hell of a lot more blood. I paused and then said, pardon my French.
Father Vincent crossed himself.
Why would his body be found there?
I shrugged. A professional did him. Look at the cuts. They're methodical. He was probably unconscious or drugged, because you can't hold a man still very easily when you're taking a knife to his face.
Father Vincent pressed one hand to his stomach.
Oh.
So you've got a corpse found out in the middle of the street somewhere, basically wearing a sign around his neck that says, the goods are in Chicago. Either someone was incredibly stupid, or someone was trying to lead you here. It's a professional killing. Someone meant his corpse to be a clue.
But
who would do such a thing? I shrugged.
Probably a good thing to find out. Do you have any better pictures of these two women?
He shook his head.
No. And they've never been arrested. No criminal record.
They're good at what they do, then.
I took the photos. There were little dossiers, paperclipped to the back of the pictures, listing known aliases, locations, but nothing terribly useful.
This one isn't going to be quick. Worthwhile goals rarely are. What do you need from me, Mr. Dresden?
A retainer, I said. 1,000 will do. And I need a description of this artifact. The more detailed, the better. Father Vincent gave me a matter-of-fact nod and drew a plain steel money clip from his pocket. He counted off 10 portraits of Ben Franklin and passed them to me.
The artifact is an oblong length of linen cloth, 14 feet, 3 inches long by 3 feet, 7 inches wide, made of a hand-woven 3-to-1 herringbone twill. There are a number of patches and stains on the cloth, and I held up my hand, frowning.
Wait a minute. Where did you say this thing was stolen from?
The Cathedral of St. John the Baptist, Father Vincent said.
In northern Italy, I said. He nodded. In Turin, to be exact, I said. He nodded again, his expression reserved.
Someone stole the freaking Shroud of Turin? I demanded.
Yes.
I settled back into the chair, looking down at the photos again. This changed things. This changed things a lot. The shroud. Supposedly the burial cloth used by Joseph of Arimathea to wrap the body of Christ after the crucifixion. Capital C's. The cloth supposedly wrapped around Christ when he was resurrected, with his image, his blood, imprinted upon it.
Wow, I said.
What do you know about the shroud, Mr. Dresden?
Not much. Christ's burial cloth. They did a bunch of tests in the 70s, and no one was able to conclusively disprove it. It almost got burned a few years back when the cathedral caught fire. There are stories that it has healing powers, or that a couple of angels still attend it. A bunch of others I can't remember right now.
Father Vincent rested his hands on the table and leaned toward me.
Mr. Dresden, the shroud is perhaps the single most vital artifact of the Church. It is a powerful symbol of the faith, and one in which many people believe. It is also politically significant. It is absolutely vital to Rome that it be restored to the Church's custody as expediently as possible.
I stared at him for a second and tried to pick out my words carefully.
Are you going to be insulted if I suggest that it's very possible that the shroud is,
significant, magically speaking?
Vincent pressed his lips together.
I have no illusions about it, Mr. Dresden. It is a piece of cloth, not a magic carpet. Its value derives solely from its historical and symbolic significance.
Uh-huh, I said.
Hell's bells, that's where plenty of magical power came from. A shroud was old and regarded as special, and people believed in it. That could be enough to give it a kind of power all by itself.
Some people might believe otherwise, I said.
Of course, he agreed. That is why your knowledge of the local occult may prove invaluable.
I nodded, thinking. This could be something completely mundane. Someone could have stolen a moldy old piece of cloth to sell it to a crackpot who believed it was a magic bedsheet. It could be that the shroud was nothing more than a symbol, an antique, a historical Pop-Tart. Nifty, but ultimately not very significant. Of course, there was also the possibility that the shroud was genuine, that it actually had been in contact with the Son of God when he had been brought back from the dead. I pushed that thought aside.
Regardless of why or how, if the shroud was something special, magically speaking, then it could mean a whole new and nastier ball game.
Of all the various weird, dark, or wicked powers who might abscond with a shroud, I couldn't think of any who would do anything cheerful with it. All sorts of supernatural interests might be at play. Even discounting that possibility, mortal pursuit of the Shroud seemed to be deadly enough. John Marcone might already be involved, as well as the Chicago police, probably Interpol and the FBI, too. Even sans supernatural powers, when it came to finding people, the cops were damned good at what they did. Odds were good that they'd locate the thieves and haul in the Shroud within a few days. I looked from the photos to the cash and thought about how many of my bills I could pay off with a nice fat fee courtesy of Father Vincent. If I got lucky, maybe I wouldn't have to put myself in harm's way to do it. Sure, I believe that. I put the money in my pocket, then I picked up the photos too. How can I get in touch with you? Father Vincent wrote a phone number on the motel's stationery and passed it to me. Here, it's my answering service while I'm in town. All right, I can't promise you anything concrete, but I'll see what I can do. Father Vincent stood up and said, Thank you, Mr. Dresden. Father Forthill spoke most highly of you, you know. He's a sport, I agreed, rising. If you will excuse me, I have appointments to keep. I'll bet. Here's my card if you need to get in touch. I gave him a business card, shook hands, and left. At the Beetle, I stopped to open the trunk and put the shotgun back in it after taking the shell from the chamber and making sure the safety was on. Then I pulled out a length of wood a little longer than my forearm, carved over with runes and sigils that helped me focus my magic a lot more precisely. I tossed my suit jacket in over the gun and dug out a silver bracelet, dangling a dozen tiny medieval-style shields from my pocket. I fastened that to my left arm, slipped a silver ring onto my right hand, then took my blasting rod and set it beside me on the car seat as I got in. Between the new case, the outfit hitter, and Duke Ortega's challenge, I wanted to make damn sure that I wasn't going to get caught with my eldritch britches down again. I took the Beetle home to my apartment. I rent the basement apartment of a huge, creaking old boarding house. By the time I got back, it was after midnight, and the late February air was speckled with occasional flakes of wet snow that wouldn't last once they hit the ground. The adrenaline rush of the Larry Fowler show and then the hired goon attack had faded and left me aching, tired, and worried. I got out of the car, determined to head for bed, then get up early and start to work on Vincent's case. A sudden sensation of cold, rippling energy and a pair of muffled thumps from the stairs leading down to my apartment changed my mind. I drew out my blasting rod and readied the shield bracelet on my left wrist. But before I could step over to the stairs, a pair of figures flew up them and landed heavily on the half-frozen ground beside the gravel parking lot. They struggled, rolling, until one of the shadowy figures got a leg underneath the form on top of it and pushed. The second figure flew 20 feet through the air, landed on the gravel with a thump and a cough of expelled air, then got up and sprinted away. Shield readied, I stepped forward before the remaining intruder could rise. I forced an effort of will through the blasting rod, setting the runes along its length alight with scarlet. Fire coalesced at the tip of the rod, bright as a road flare. But I held the strike as I stepped forward, shoving the tip of the blasting rod down at the intruder. Make a move, and I'll fry you. Red light fell over a woman. She was dressed in jeans, a black leather jacket, a white t-shirt, and gloves. She had her long midnight hair tied back in a tail. Dark, oblique eyes smoldered up at me from beneath long lashes. Her beautiful face held an expression of wary amusement. My heart thudded in sudden pain and excitement. Well, Susan said, looking from the sizzling blasting rod up to my face. I've heard of running into an old flame, but this is ridiculous. Chapter 4 Susan. My brain locked up for a good 10 seconds as I stared down at my former lover. I could smell the scent of her hair, the subtle perfume she wore, mixing with the new leather scent of her jacket, and another new smell. New soap, maybe. Her dark eyes regarded me, uncertain and nervous. She had a small cut on the side of her mouth, beading with drops of blood that looked black in the red light of the blasting rod's fire. Harry, Susan said, her voice quiet and steady. Harry, you're scaring me. I shook myself out of my surprise and lowered the blasting rod, stepping over to her.
Stars and stones, Susan, are you all right?
I offered her my hand, and she took it, rising easily to her feet. Her fingers were feverishly warm, and wisps of winter steam curled from her skin. Bruises, she said. I'll be fine. Who was that? Susan glanced the way her attacker had run and shook her head. Redcourt, I couldn't see his face.